more of Lake Effect Now. I'm Mitch Tyke. It's time for our weekly series, The Islands of Milwaukee.
Welcome to the Islands of Milwaukee.
This is Maureen Towey with the Islands of Milwaukee. We're continuing to explore the sounds of Milwaukee, and this week we have some helpers. We've been working closely with the Goodwill programs that deliver meals to seniors in their homes. The meal delivery drivers we've encountered are a fun, lively bunch.
I'm Diane Kongshug, and I drive the getaway car.
My name is Dwayne Kongshug. I'm a driver out of Beulah Britain. I've been with drivers for about a year and a half, maybe.
Hi, my name is Pat Sprung. I've been working with the Meals on Wheels for 20 years now, and I love it because you have so many grandmas and grandpas and aunts and uncles. I have a client named Max or Maxine, and the question of the day was, what is the most beautiful sound in the world? And she said to me, I know exactly what you're going to say. And I said, what was that, Max? And she said, you're going to say the sound of a crying baby after it's been born. And I said, no, I'm on the other end of the spectrum. I enjoy the sound of taps played on bugle.
Here are a few more answers that the drivers found.
The most beautiful sound in the world, the ripple of $100 bills.
Record player playing Chet Atkins.
The other one was my cat purring on my lap.
These drivers are navigating between homes that might otherwise be isolated. They are great, quiet connectors of the city. We have more questions of the day to be answered, and we would love to hear from you. We would love for you to take these questions to family, neighbors, or friends. Visit our website, call our islands line, help us uncover some of the secret stories of the seniors of Milwaukee. Thanks for listening.
You can participate in the Islands of Milwaukee project by calling the Islands hotline at 414-678-1653 or by visiting islandsofmilwaukee.org. Although they've been long gone from the Midwest landscape and skies, and in fact any landscape and skies at all, the passenger pigeon will be very much alive as the subject of an event tonight at the Riverside Park Urban Ecology Center in Milwaukee. The extinction of the pigeon occurred just short of a century ago, September 1, 1914, when Martha, the last of the species, died in captivity in the Cincinnati Zoo. Natural historian and researcher Joel Greenberg looked closely at the life and death of the species in his recent book, A Feathered River Across the Sky. And ahead of tonight's talk, Greenberg told WUWM's Susan Bence he hopes his research heightens awareness of the importance of conservation efforts today. He says his awareness of the passenger pigeon began way back when he was a grade school student.
I was in school in Skokie, Illinois, and I checked out of the library a book called Birds of America by T. Gilbert Pearson. You're allowed to check books out for 2 weeks at a time. So about the third time in a row that I checked it out, the librarian suggested I perhaps look at other books. But I've been interested in animals all my life. And at the age of 12, I became an avid birder. So of course, the bird learned more about birds. And over the years since, the decades since, I've had a particularly strong interest in what I call historical natural history. How has a region or the country changed in its flora and fauna over the years, mostly due to human changes? And so when you look at the eastern half of the United States and Canada, the story of the passenger pigeon looms just as an incredible story, both of abundance, and indeed, it's the ultimate manifestation of how rich this area was. And then on the other side, you see how quickly the vast population of passenger pigeons were depleted, also reflecting the depletion of other biological resources. it's a sad story, but it also led to changes. And there are lessons in that story which I believe are critically relevant for today.
You talked a bit about your career, where you went beyond fourth grade, but then you came back to the pigeon. It was the anniversary, wasn't it, of its extinction?
I've talked to editors about doing a passenger pigeon book, but the impending anniversary, 2014 now, of the bird's extinction gave it greater currency. And so I think that this is a unique opportunity to tell people about this really remarkable story.
So in 2011, Project Passenger Pigeon came together. This is 150 or more institutions that are involved. Can you talk about that?
Sure. So I started work on the book in August of 2009. And in the process of my research, I learned that other people were thinking about the anniversary. There were a series of conference calls. I met people at the Cincinnati Zoo, met people at the Chicago Academy of Sciences, Peggy Notobart Nature Museum. There were a series of conference calls which led to a meeting hosted by Notobart in February of 2011. This brought people in from places like Cornell, the Smithsonian, Philadelphia Academy of Sciences, and out of that meeting came Project Passenger Pigeon. Specifically, what we hope to do is four things: tell people the story of the bird, use that story as a portal into consideration of current issues, specifically about extinction, our relationship with nature, and the need to build more sustainable relations with the species that we do use. And I think we've been really successful. We have, as you mentioned, probably over 160 organizations, even a few in faraway places. Their involvement varies, but between programming, exhibits, we also made a point to try to engage artists, and that's shown great success. There's a mural in downtown Cincinnati, for example, of showing the pigeons, because I think it's important, that we use as many techniques, use as many media as possible in bringing in new folks who might not otherwise have heard the story of the bird.
So back to the story of the bird. For those who don't know it, can you give us an overview of its state of abundance to extinction?
Sure. To me, the bird was unlike any other that human beings have ever known, and this for three principal reasons. First, it was incredibly abundant, probably had a population in the billions, but was certainly the most common bird in North America and perhaps the world. Secondly, that population often formed huge aggregations that are almost unbelievable today. So John Audubon did a three-day trip in Kentucky along the Ohio River, and for the entire 3 days, the sun was blocked by flights of passenger pigeons. The third point, and to segue into it, one of the largest flights ever recorded occurred near Fort Mississauga, Ontario, which is about 60 or 70 miles from Toronto. This was in May, probably around 1860, when likely anywhere from 2 to 3.7 billion birds crossed the skies over the course of 3 days. So that's 1860. 40 years later, due to human action, the bird was gone from the wild. The last wild birds were killed in the very first few years of the 20th century. And 14 years later, on September 1st, 1914, the very last of the species died, rendering it extinct. And it became extinct mostly because of unrelenting killing. The birds were chased throughout the year. They were prevented from nesting. Where they roosted, they were killed. A whole range of devices were used to kill them. And so that's really, the three points that I think make this bird unique.
So why were they so sought after?
Mostly for food. They would sell for pennies a piece. They were the cheapest terrestrial protein. And so with the introduction of the telegraph and railroad in the 1840s, there developed national markets. And that the same time as the urban centers of the Midwest and East began to burgeon, there was a demand for cheap food. The birds were used for other reasons as well. One worth noting, they were used in trap meat. So now when you go out, pigeons are made out of clay, but back then they were made out of feathers and blood. And so as many as 40,000 birds could be shot at a single three-day tournament. Now that's a relatively small part in comparison, but when you think about what it took to ship live birds from places like Arkansas or, you know, northern Wisconsin to New York or Chicago, a lot of birds died in the passage as well.
So, Joel, who was paying attention when it came down to the last few birds and a pigeon being kept in the Cincinnati Zoo? What, you know, when did alarms start going off in some people's heads?
Well, you know, there never was really an organized effort to protect the birds. That was for several reasons. One is there was an industry that was promoting the idea that the bird was still abundant. The bird laid lots of eggs and nested multiple times of the year. In reality, they nested once a year and they only laid one egg a year. So there were still, you know, even towards the early 1882 or so, there were still one or two places where, you know, maybe there were a few hundred thousand birds, which for most birds would seem a lot, but, you know, just a fraction of what there were. So in 1900, the birds were virtually gone from the wild, but there were three captive flocks, one in Milwaukee, a man named Whitaker, who also had a swimming school and apparently very prominent on the Milwaukee River. And then some of his birds wound up in Chicago under the care of Professor Charles Otis Whitman of University of Chicago and the Cincinnati flock. And so at that point, these birds were being bred in captivity, but it's important to know that this wasn't part of a conservation effort. You know, nowadays zoos breed animals. Sometimes they're released in the wild. Sometimes, you know, they are the only living members of a species. But back then, conservation wasn't part of it. When they got down to one or two birds in Cincinnati, you know, there was some effort to try to locate maybe other birds to augment the few old birds they had. But those efforts were way too late to provide, you know, any real possibility of success. Oh, let me just ask this real quick. There are virtually no photos of the birds, either alive or dead, and I have not found any photos of Whitaker's birds. And I don't know, I mean, I've reached out to the Milwaukee Historical Society and various institutions, the museum, and I would love, it would be great if there were photos. People visited his passenger pigeons and they wrote about it, but I've never seen any photos of his passenger pigeons.
So, Joel, you titled your final chapter Extinction and Beyond, and you talked about the mission of Project Passenger Pigeon and your book of having some impact on the issues of today and what might come tomorrow. Talk about that.
Sure. One way I phrase it is that the passenger pigeon story is the best cautionary tale there is to the proposition that no matter how abundant something is, could be water, could be fuel, could be something alive, if we're not good stewards, we can lose it. To me, that message is pretty much, you know, throughout the planet. And so what we're hoping to do is make people vigilant. I mean, if something as abundant as a passenger pigeon can be wiped out in 40 or 50 years, something less common can go in an eye blink. We have a law, the Federal Endangered Species Protection Act, that 1969 to 1973. That law was a commitment by this country that we would not allow, or at least we would not allow it without a struggle, for species to become extinct. And now the Endangered Species Act is under grave attack. So one of our goals would be to get people concerned enough to let their lawmakers know that they believe that the richness of nature is important and that we should do what we can to maintain the web of life and biodiversity.
We're in the beginnings of migration season, and I was thinking of leaving the listeners with what the landscape, what the skies, what they look like now versus what people would have experienced more than 100 years ago.
Well, this idea...
Well over 100, I should say.
Yeah, really, because the last big aggregations were probably 1882 or so. It is something that people have been talking about, and it's striking to me. I mean, each generation has its baseline. So imagine somebody who was cognizant of nature in the 1860s, then talking, you know, to a young relative who grew up in the 20 years later, and 20 years after that. I was talking to a herpetologist, Steve Swanson, here in Chicago, and he related to me how he used to go out nearby, turn over logs, and find maybe 10 or 15 garter snakes. And he was out just a few days before I had met him, and with some kids, young people, and they found 5. And you can just imagine, you know, those kids talking to, their children, maybe they'll find 1 or 2. Now, you know, there are success stories. Sandhill cranes, which you're talking about migration. Last week, they flew over Chicago by the thousands. 30 years ago, they were almost gone from the Midwest. So, you know, that's a bird that has just done spectacularly well. And so there are success stories. Those are the ones, you know, every time I hear sandhills as I'm trying to work in my, office here in the Chicago suburbs, it's hard to concentrate when that trumpeting, you know, permeates the windows. But, you know, it's inspiration to keep going because, you know, hopefully that story can be repeated.
Joel Greenberg, thank you so much for being with us.
Well, thank you so much for interviewing me.
Joel Greenberg is the author of A Feathered River Across the Sky, The Passenger Pigeon's Flight to Extinction. He spoke with Susan Bentz. He'll talk about the passenger pigeon tonight at the Riverside Park Urban Ecology Center in Milwaukee. We are not going extinct, but it'll be another 23 hours before you can join us for the next Lake Effect. We'll look at Wisconsin employment trends in the last decade and what they mean, and then ask the pressing question, is Superman really Jewish? I'm Mitch Tyke. Thanks so much for tuning in today, and I hope you'll tune in again tomorrow and every weekday morning at 10 for another edition of Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio, NPR in Milwaukee. Stay tuned. Fresh air is next. It's 11 o'clock.